Case number 12-1340. West Deptford Energy LLC petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Parrish for the petitioner, Ms. Kafer for the respondent, Mr. Flynn for the intervener.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Ashley Parrish for West Deptford. I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, the Court should reject the Commission's new position that as long as a utility tells a customer that it wants to charge a different rate, that the Commission then has discretion to set aside the statutory filed rate requirements. What I'd like to do this morning is three things. First, draw the Court's attention to the two controlling statutory provisions. Second, address the Commission's two principal arguments advanced in their brief, both which cannot be reconciled with those statutory provisions. And then third, say a few words about policy and the burden that would be put on this Court if the Commission's position was accepted. Starting with the statutory provisions themselves, let me just say as a footnote that both in the briefs and in the Court's cases, we often refer to the filed rate doctrine. In the case of the Federal Power Act, that's a little bit misleading because it really isn't a doctrine in the way of a judge-made rule, but it actually comes out of the statute itself. And there are two provisions where you can find that. The first, and both of these provisions are reproduced on page 5 of our appendix in the blue brief. The first one is section 205C. That's the filed rate requirement. It makes clear that every utility shall file with the Commission all rates and charges for any transmission or sale that's subject to the Commission's jurisdiction. So that's the first filed rate requirement. The second requirement is section 205D. That's on the next page, page 6. That sets out what is referred to as the plain statement rule, that no change shall be made to any rate unless the utility provides 60 days notice by filing schedules that state plainly both the change that is to be made and the time when that change will go into effect. Those two provisions are controlling in this case because it is undisputed that the tariff that was on file when West Deptford was offered the sale of interconnection service, that tariff went into effect in August 2008.
Can I back you up there? So, yes, the statute says there has to be a rate on file. Does the statute say when it has to be on file, i.e. when you get in a queue versus when you start a process with a utility versus when you sign on the dotted line? Where's that in the statute?
Your Honor, the statute doesn't say that, but what it does say in that language on 205D is that the tariff, when it's changing, must both state the change to be made and the time when the change will be in effect.
I think that all just begs the question of when this operative statutory requirement kicks in, which is really the issue of this case. You have two filed rates, two tariffs. The question is which one governs.
Yeah, with respect, Your Honor, you don't. And the reason is you have the first tariff that was on file, and then they submitted a second tariff, and that second tariff was designed to supersede that earlier tariff. Now, what it could have done is it could have had a grandfathering provision, which would have said, well, it's superseding everything but not this particular provision, or it could have had a plain statement that would have said, going forward, we will apply the provisions in the old tariff. But as for all practical matters, it doesn't have either of those two things.
But I think the problem is that you say going forward. So we have to ask the question of what happens when you don't have the grandfathering provision. And then you say, well, once the tariff is applied, then going forward it applies. But I think the question that Judge Millett is asking, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that we don't know what going forward means because you have to understand what triggers going forward. Which set of folks in the queue are in the going forward population and which set are in the going backwards population? And I think could have specified in the tariff itself, they could have made a specification.
But, Your Honor, and what I would say about that is that in the tariff applies to all customers. There's no distinction in the tariff between people in the queue or not in the queue. Now, we can talk about commission precedent, which is also very clear on this. And so I don't want to lose that point. But just looking at the statute itself, the way that the statute works is that you have a tariff. You can only have one tariff on file at a time. The tariff, there's an existing tariff. It then gets replaced by a tariff that supersedes it. And then that tariff takes over.
But it doesn't take over. I mean, takes over for what? If you had existing ongoing contracts, it wouldn't replace those numbers in an existing contract, right?
Well, because not if it was an interconnection agreement that was signed, that is correct.
Right. So it doesn't immediately destroy the effect of that prior tariff if there was already a legal relationship based on the prior tariff.
It doesn't destroy the contract. That is correct, if there's a contract that has been established. And, Your Honor, that goes to our point, which is, you know, I was going to address two of the Commission's arguments. Your Honor's questions go to this first argument, which is that it's not the tariff that's in effect. It's the tariff that used to be in effect. And if you look at page 5 of our reply brief, we cite, I think, 8 cases in the MISO proceedings, and also in the later on, there's, you know, several cases here, the Mid-American case as well, where the Commission has always said, for purposes of cost allocation relating to upgrades, you look at the tariff that is in effect at the time the agreement is signed. And that takes me back to 205C, which says that the service that you're paying for, the rate that is in file, is not the rate that is for the request for service at some point in the future. It's for the sale. And the question then is, what is the sale? And the sale that is going on here is not the money you pay to do the studies. So sure, you go into the queue and you pay $10,000 to do an initial study, you sign an agreement to do that, and then you do another study if you meet some milestones and you pay $50,000 to do that. There are agreements that govern each step in the queue, and at not one point in that queue process are you getting a sale of interconnection service. That does not happen until you're presented with an interconnection agreement. And then at that time, what the Commission has said in those decisions on page 5 of our reply brief is it has said very clearly that it's the tariff that is in effect that governs the terms. And the Commission has used that to say that you can't take advantage of new tariffs and you can't take advantage of old tariffs. You have to do whatever the tariff is on file.
Can I ask just a factual operational question? When it said those studies at each stage seem to allocate cost responsibility, is cost responsibility a percentage or is it a dollar sign? I mean, what is a cost responsibility? Is we think you're going to increase the need by 50%, so that's what we're determining, or it's going to cost you this much?
So they're estimates of amount of money. What they do is there's different categories of things you might be responsible for, but what we're talking about here are upgrades that might be needed to the system that, because you're destabilizing it or otherwise. And if they decide that you are a but-for cause of that upgrade, then you might be responsible for paying for it. And what they will do in the study is they'll give a non-binding estimate of what they think the cost might be.
Based on the tariff existing at the time of the study?
Based on the existing tariff and their views as to what it would be. Now, here, of course, we think they violated the tariff because the first study came out before the tariff was changed, and the two other studies came out after the tariff. At that point, West Deptford said, you know, your studies are wrong. You're not doing what the tariff told you to do. But the only way that you can tee that dispute up is the Commission's been very clear in its Dominion case, sort of a precursor to this one, that the studies are non-final and they're non-binding. So what you have to do is if you have a dispute, you have to challenge that dispute at the time that you are presented with the interconnection agreement. You can either sign it, in which case the terms govern, or you can file it unexecuted, which is what we did here, which means that you present a dispute and it goes up to the court. One thing I would note that on this first argument that the court is focusing on, and really which is the Commission's first argument, if you take a look at page 16 of their brief, this is where they make that argument. They cite no statutory provision, no regulation, or case law that has ever supported their position on this. The only thing they cite is the rehearing order paragraphs 30 and 41, that's on JA 29 and 33, and their initial order paragraph 35, JA 13. If you take a look at those, you'll see that there's no cites there either. In fact, if you look at the Commission's table of authorities, in a case that has everything to do with what the statute requires, it is telling that they cite section 205 only once on page 24 of their brief, and it's a drive-by citing that has to do with a brief mention but has no relevance to their arguments in the case.
Is your position that the statute would forbid them, as a matter of their interpretive discretion, from adopting a rule that said, as to these types of cost allocations, it's going to be the tariff when you get in the queue or when you sign, one way or the other? Is that completely beyond their discretion, or is the problem that they have to have a decision one way or the other?
Your Honor is absolutely right. If they wanted to, there's several different ways that they could take these policies that they think are important and make them effective. One would be to go through a prospective rulemaking that would say that all of the open access tariffs on file would henceforth set forth this rule. The other thing that they could do is they could include a grandfathering provision when they approve individual tariffs that would say this tariff, to the extent we're talking about cost allocation, it will relate back to the queue position. But notably, they are, in this court, unwilling to actually even say that that's what they want. And the reason is because most of the time the commission does not want that to be ruled. It really seems like this is a one-off justification. They have their policy reasons for it, but those policy reasons have to give way to the primacy of the policy in the statute, which is that the statute says there's a way that you change rates. So, Your Honor, it's absolutely right. There's no problem with the commission figuring out that it wants a new rule going forward. What it can't do is go ahead and discriminate against individual customers outside the process that the statute sets forth, which is that utilities file rates. Those rates govern the terms of interconnection agreements, and every customer, when they stand up, gets to take advantage of that.
What's the statutory language again that tells you? There's statutory language that tells you that the rates on file govern. But yes. What's the statutory language that tells you the temporal part of that? That rate applies to and when?
Yes, if you take a look at, I'm not sure about who it applies to. If you take a look at 205C, which is the first one, this is how we interpret the statute. It says, it makes the point in 205C that it should be all rates and charges for any transmission or sale. And what this court has said and what the commission has said is that requires that in order to figure out what the rate is, you have to know what the sale is. And so the question here is, what is the sale and when did the sale occur? If the sale here is the interconnection service that's provided, that is the only service that to which these costs attach, then the sale has to be the rate that applies to that, which is the rate that is on file. And we support that by the fact that that's how the commission has always interpreted it. And again, on page 5 of our reply brief in the MISO hearings, the Mid-American case, we cite chapter and verse of commission decisions that have held exactly this for purposes of ruling against.
But if it had a grandfathering provision that made clear that the new tariff did not apply to folks who are in the position of your client, it would still meet this criteria. It would still show all rates and charges for any transmission or sale.
Well, if you had a grandfathering provision, it would comply, because what it would do at that point is it would put everybody on notice what the terms of the tariff were, and you would know at the time by looking at the tariff what your rate would be. If I can turn the court back to thinking about the filed rate doctrine with the old common carriage, you had a railroad and you had a shipper, there could be all the notice that is provided in the world to the shipper on the side of the railroad said that we're going to discriminate against you, and you will be subject to some other rate. But at the time that the shipper goes to take service, the shipper is willing to is able to stand on its rights and say, no, whatever rate is in the commission, before the commission right now, that's the one that applies. Now, the commission...
So your point, then, in response to Judge Rosen's question, is, isn't it the D is what requires them to have the grandfather clause? You have to plainly state when the change is going to...
Your Honor, yes. That it's a combination of the two, but you're absolutely right. It's the combination that it has to connect the rate to the sale, and then second, if they're not going to do that, it has to plainly state when the new rate will be effective. What was plainly stated in this tariff is this...
No, we're talking about drive-by arguments. I did not notice that argument when I read the blue brief, and turns out the reason I didn't notice it is all you do is cite at page 31 and 32 the language, but you don't make the argument until the reply brief that you're making now. Instead, you say the rule derived from these statutory requirements is known as the filed rate doctrine, and then you go on and discuss the filed rate doctrine in the cases.
Well, Your Honor, it is true that in response to the arguments that the commission raised, we focus more on the statutory language, but there's no doubt that the filed rate doctrine that the court's cases talk about that we cite in the opening...
If that were true, then neither of the notice exceptions, which you concede are okay, would be okay.
Not at all, Your Honor. Both of those would be fine. The first notice...
Neither of them is in the tariff.
No, actually, Your Honor, with respect, the first one is in the tariff. So the first one is situations where there's a change in the tariff, like a formula rate. Of course, cases say that's fine. That's an enforcement of the statutory language. The only other circumstance which applies rarely, but is a situation where the rate has been challenged in court. And the reason why that is appropriate is because under Section 205 and Section 206, the purpose of the statute is to allow a process where parties can challenge these rates after a notice has been given. And so what the court has reasonably said is that we can't have a situation where the court determines that the rate is unlawful.
That's an extra textual exception.
Your Honor, I'd say that is consistent with the structure of the statute. There, I can't point to you specific language, but I can point to, if you look at 205 and 206, and the idea...
But in describing the structure of the statute and the purpose of the statute, we repeatedly talk about it being notice. Notice is what's at issue, and you had notice in this case.
So, Your Honor, you've taken me now to their second argument. Thank you. The thing about the second argument is that it cannot be what the commission says it is, because if it is notice in just terms of any notice, then the file rate doctrine goes away entirely. because you're already at the bottom of the slope. So there has to be some explanation as to what the limiting principle. Again, if you look at page, I believe it's 18 of their brief, this is where they make this argument. They cite no notice case ever that has applied it in this way. Instead, what they do is they cite notice cases for the general principle that if you have notice, that is one of the purposes, although only one of the purposes.
Can you represent to me that there are no notice cases that fall outside your two doors, one being it's notice of the text of the tariff because they essentially give you a formula that's uncertain, or it's been, you know, the consequence of judicial review, and otherwise there would be no incentive for anyone to undertake judicial review. Are there no other notice circumstances in our precedent?
Your Honor, I will represent to you two things. One is that we have not been able to find any other, but I don't know if there might be. And number two is that they have not cited a single other case, even though they've done this. This was addressed both in their initial order, their rehearing, and now on appeal.
So there's no notice case like this either way, is that right?
Well, no, Your Honor. What I would say is that there is no notice case like this, and it can't possibly be that the notice provision goes as far.
That's a different question. I'm asking whether there's any precedent in your favor in which there was notice like this, where FERC argued this, and a court has ruled against FERC.
Your Honor, I have not done this, except for I would just point the court to all the filed rate doctrine cases, which set a general principle that the idea is
there's
that
there's obviously a dispute about that. So, certainly the agency can, faced with a new set of facts, can come up with a new rule with respect to notice in a regulatory adjudication and apply it.
Yep.
And it's not rulemaking, this is an adjudication.
Yep.
So they could determine, as they did here, whether there was precedent for it or not, that where there's this kind of notice, that's sufficient.
Your Honor, they could determine that in a rulemaking.
No, they could determine it in adjudication.
Respectfully, no, because the whole point of the filed rate doctrine and the statutory requirements here is that you take this discretion away from the agency.
Well, that's only if you're right about the filed rate doctrine. But the issue that you're raising, which was there's no precedent, that alone doesn't stop them from creating a new precedent with new facts.
Your Honor, the notice exception is a judicially created exception. We cite cases in our brief that make the point that because it's in the context of the filed rate doctrine, the agency gets no discretion. So if the court wants to create a new notice exception, then the court might be able to do that, but the agency doesn't have discretion to do that. And we don't think there's any basis for the court to do it.
Can I just clarify what you're telling me about our notice precedent?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying that everything falls into your two categories. Or are you just saying you haven't found one like this? Different things?
Yes, so, Your Honor, I want to be careful because obviously there's always the unprovided fourth, third case.
Right.
The cases that we have looked at and that have been cited in the brief, we believe all of them fall into either one or both of the two categories that I've cited for you.
So how would you articulate?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Could you
I was just going to say one or two of both. Now, there could be, hypothetically, you could imagine there might be some other case out there. I don't see how that case could be relevant unless it's tied back to the statute, and we can't think of any other third provided case that would be consistent with the statute. Put another way, the court's notice cases are, again, they're not an exception to the statute. They're a way of applying the statute in a way that makes the statute make sense. The commission's reading here eviscerates the statute because what it means is that the commission essentially, and you can see this in a brief, it wants discretion to be able to say not that the filed rate is the one that happens at the queue. It hasn't made that position, or certainly hasn't taken steps to put that in force. It wants to say that if a utility gives you actual notice, as long as they yell from the rooftops that we're going to charge you the wrong rate, then the commission has discretion whenever it wants to set aside the statutory requirements. And our submission is that's wrong.
Can I get, and again, I'm sorry, this is just a factual question. I wasn't not sure I understood something in the record. They said the effective date for the new tariff was going to be August 1, 2008. But it would apply to the U2Q, which closed on July 31st. And so I'm trying to figure out whether that means they're actually backing up the effective date to people who got in line before August 1, or am I just misunderstanding?
How these
queues close?
Your Honor, I have to say I think I understand it, but let me give you the appellate lawyers as opposed to the FERC lawyers' answer to that. Is that, let me just correct something, if I may. In the transmittal letter, which the commission relies on, all that PJM says is that it will be effective August 1st in order to address the most upcoming queue. The reason they say that is most of the changes in the tariff relate to queue process changes, nothing to do with cost allocation. So the U2 queue that the commission then talks about is something that the commission pulls out later from the answer that's put in PGM. As I understand it, the queue comes up, and because they're looking at doing studies and other things like that, that those changes would have affected, not the cost allocation, but these other things, that basically starting in the U2 queue, which might have been just before August or whatever, they're going to start applying this new...
Well, I guess the reason I'm asking the question is there's a rule that says it's when you get in the queue, or there's a rule when you sign, and then they say, well, there's an effective date, but the effective date actually applies to people who got in the queue before the effective date. That's what it sounds like to me. The queue closes on July 31st, and they're getting the benefit of it, that they, in fact, are having yet another theory here for who gets covered by the new tariff that is inconsistent with the effective date, but I might just not understand.
What I was, and Your Honor, I have to say that's not a question that I've sort of thought about deeply, but what I would say is that, first, there is really no rule except for what the commission has said here about entering the queue. And so what you're usually looking at is just the question of when you're in the queue, what happens? A new tariff comes up, and they say we'd like an effective date of August. It doesn't matter whether you're in the queue or not. What it matters is that when you next come up for your next study, what are the rules that apply to that? What are the rules that apply when you enter your interconnection agreement? And again, it's because it's the sale that the statute says it's important. So it's a question of when you take the sale. Is it the sale of the study process or the sale otherwise? I did say, Your Honors, that I would make sort of three really quick points about the policy.
So let me just to back you up for 1 second on this. The original letter from PJM says, because the next interconnection queue will begin on August 1st, PJM requests an August 1st effective date.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what you were referring to just now?
That is what I was referring to, yes, Your Honor.
And you don't think that can... In the subsequent letters, they specifically say, maybe more clearly, they're intended to be effective as of August 1st and will be initially applied to the U2 queue.
So, Your Honor, making sure that I'm clear here, what I was focusing on is that the commission, in its orders, looks at four different things that it said provided us notice. Yeah. And the first thing it talks about is this transmittal letter. Yeah. And one of the things about the transmittal letter that's important is that's the thing that actually came with the tariff. But in there, all that it really says is that it will be effective on 2008. That's our point, which is we didn't sign the interconnection agreement until, or presented with it until 2011. So what that says at the time, according to D, plainly stated, is that it will be effective.
But that leaves out the introductory clause, which says, because the new interconnection queue will begin on August 1st.
Well, Your Honor, and that is only, my point about that is that that is contextual with the fact that most of these tariff provisions have to deal with changing the queue process, and so they're providing the commission a reason why they think the 2008 date is effective, but they're not putting us on notice in that letter that they expect that there will be a different rule.
Is it clear enough in the other letters, in the letter that says will be applied to the U2 queue effective August 1st, and particularly in the answer?
So, Your Honor, there's three other things. There's the answer, there's the studies, and then there's the commission's letter order. The letter order that you're asking about was not raised as a justification for
I'm not talking about the letter order.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's what the government argued in the brief, right?
But not below. That's right.
Right.
And it also doesn't apply.
We don't have to pay any attention to that because FERC did not rely on that either. You appear to be right on the reading of it, and maybe that's why FERC didn't rely on it.
Exactly. So then, Your Honor, we're left with only two things that the FERC has relied on. One is the PJM answer that was filed, and then the second one was the studies. So let's take a look at both of those. First of all, an answer is not a schedule that is filed in accord with Section 202D. It's a brief.
Are they right that your parent was in this same proceeding?
They are right that our parent was, yes.
So are you suggesting you didn't have actual notice of their position?
Your Honor, I'm not sure whether I wouldn't take a position on whether it's actual notice.
So you're not arguing that there wasn't actual notice.
We say that the studies, we recognize that we had actual notice that the utility wanted to charge us a different rate. We did not have actual notice as that they were going to get rid of the filed rate, but we did have actual notice that it was the utility's intent to charge us something else. Mm-hmm. But the PGM answer, in order for them to change the rate, which is what they're doing there, it has to be filed in a schedule in accordance with Section 205D. This is not a schedule.
That's,
it's a brief.
That's if you win on the notice point.
Your Honor, if I win on what the statute says with respect.
Well, it's with respect to whether a note, there is a notice exception or not, right?
This is true, but I think even still, Your Honor, when looking at whether the notice is legally counts or not, you have to look at what the statute says as to and what the filed rate doctrine is. And so the point of the filed rate doctrine is that everybody in the world can take a look at the schedules on file with the commission. There's 60 days, so everyone can look at them and they can protest. Now, here, there was a process, a stakeholder process, that resulted in a settlement where everyone agreed that the old procedures made no sense, and they shortened dramatically the time that would apply for when you'd be responsible for these older costs. So it would be 5 years from the date that the first interconnection agreement was entered, necessitating them. So in this case, back in 2001, not 5 years from when the project actually went into service.
Are there benefits to having the queue position? Right, there are benefits to having. There's a reason people get in the queue. I mean, you're trying to have your cake and eat it here. You want all the benefits of being in the queue position, but then none of the tariff that came with that queue position.
So, Your Honor, 2 points. One is there are benefits, but your other question goes to that point, which is that there's a way in order to take advantage of those benefits that's consistent with the statute. And two, Your Honor, with respect, there's two things as to why we're not sort of taking benefits of this. One is that this was a stakeholder process that everyone negotiated together, and the point was to change the unfair provisions and make them fair. We're just trying to take advantage of the fair ones. And second, this happens all the time. The tariffs change, and then the customers end up getting a disadvantage as a result. And if we had entered into...
Does it happen often, or do they normally have grandfather clauses? Is this unusual that there wasn't any explanation as to which of these filed rates is going to govern?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that it is not uncommon for the commission to approve grandfather clauses. It is also the case that the commission has always said that what applies is the tariffs in effect. So what's unusual here is both that nobody thought about putting a grandfather clause in because that was part of the deal. Nobody wanted to open up that deal. And second of all, that what the commission is trying to do is, even though everyone's entitled to rely on the deal and the tariff that was approved, we're now it's okay to reopen the deal just for one party, for us.
And would it really be true? I mean, some people would plan accordingly, but under your theory, you guys could be ready, the night before, the minute before you're about to sign your agreement, and then a new tariff descends. And that's the one that governs?
And that has happened, Your Honor. And in fact, in the cases, the MISO cases, it's the flip side, which is that they submit the agreement under the old tariff, and very shortly after that, there's a new tariff. And the commission has been very clear, I'm sorry, you're out of luck. It's when you sign for the sale, when the sale occurred, when you agreed to take the service, at that point, that's what the tariff tells you what the terms are. And here we knew what the terms were.
Are those cases where that was clear in the tariff?
No, Your Honor, what the commission in those cases was saying was that a party was coming in saying we'd like to take advantage of a new tariff that has just come out, even though we saw that send their agreement. And what the commission says is no, under the statute, the rule is that at the time that the interconnection agreement is signed, it's whatever tariff is in effect and on file. Of course, that makes a lot of sense because that's how it works. Now, it is true that you may want more predictability with these studies, but those things change. In this case, on itself, Mantua Creek left. And the studies that were done were no longer valid anymore. But the utility can deal with that by just making sure that they think in advance. It's a sort of a rule, utilitarian rule, that forces everyone to think, well, what should the tariff be?
FERC has said that those studies don't lock in rates, correct?
PJM has said the words lock in rates, but you're right. In the Dominion proceedings, they say it's non-final and non-binding, which is why you can't challenge the studies. They don't want you coming in and say, oh, we think the cost estimates are wrong. It's like buying the mortgage. You know, you get the mortgage company will send you all the estimates as to what they think you're going to pay, but until you sign on the dotted line, it's just an estimate. It's the same thing here. That's the whole process. You get some predictability, but until you get the interconnection agreement, no sale is occurring, and you don't know what it's going to be.
They say you're not bound by the amount or by the tariff at all.
Well, you're not bound by it either for the sale of interconnection in the sense that you don't make any commitment until you're presented with the interconnection agreement. So the studies are steps that you pay for along the way. You can come in and out. You can't come back in. I'm sorry. You can step out anytime that you want and walk away from the table. All you're doing is paying for that study. And then the studies are not binding in the sense that if there's something in the study that, like, let's say they've gone the other way, that the estimates had been woefully too low, and then we've got our interconnection agreement, they suddenly jacked it up by, you know, $10 million. We might have a argument as to why the interconnection agreement is not right, but we couldn't base it on the studies because the studies are non-binding, non-binding. They're just
good. It has to be based on the tariff. Right?
It has to be based on the tariff.
You can't argue that the tariff doesn't apply. All you can do is argue about the tariff.
Exactly.
And can I have a practical question with respect to the answer, the question that was raised about the answer notice coming via that answer?
Yeah.
Is there some way that one can tell by looking just at the name of cases on a docket when FERC is talking about, is doing something, has litigation involving a tariff that might be applying to you? I was in a FERC hearing.
So, Your Honor, that is in the Dominion proceeding, which is docket number 36. I think, you know, if you knew enough about the dockets and stuff, you might realize that the tariff had been filed and there was a question, and maybe you might know that there was a clarification that had been filed, but it really is like, you know, if when we tried to find the answer in the docket, it takes a lot of work with legal systems to actually identify these things, because they're not, and this is the reason why the commission has schedules, which is that you should be able to just go up, pull up the schedules, and that will tell you what the rate is, and you don't have to look behind the screen to figure out, you know, who's asked for clarification and what the utility has said one way or the other.
And even had you, if you didn't know about it, your parent calls you up and says, by the way, here's what they're saying about the tariff that's going to govern you. Do you have any procedural mechanism to then challenge that, or do you just have to wait until, again, you're at the sign on the dotted line point?
Whether there might be a procedural mechanism that we could creatively try to do, I don't know of anyone that would be successful, in the sense that what you're supposed to do, and this is, again, what they say in Dominion, is that you wait till you get to the interconnection agreement, and then there's a process under the statute, and the statute says, okay, now we can air this out, and you can either stand on your rights or you get crushed by the tariff, and that's where it is. You know, let me just say one point here, which goes back to the policy. You know, I've already answered the one question, which is that they can achieve this through a grandfather provision, rulemaking, general tariff, so that's easy. If you look at the equities, let me just emphasize the whole point of the statutory filed rate doctrine is to avoid an inquiry into case-by-case equities, which is where we're going. But if you wanted to do that, as I mentioned before, the equities favor us, which is really, this does seem like the commission had a very hard line for Marcus Hook, where they said, we're going to force you to comply with the filed rate, the agreement that you signed, and you're out of luck, even though circumstances have changed. And now they seem to be wanting to make it up by Marcus Hook by deviating from the tariff for us. And the last thing I would say, Your Honors, is maybe in your own interest, which is that if the commission is right here and it becomes just a discretionary call, then the whole system blows up. I mean, the filed rate doctrine and the statutory requirements have been very helpful in weeding out unnecessary disputes, because everyone can look at the tariff. If it becomes a question of the commission exercising discretion, then this court could well be deluged with FERC cases, and I think it's fair to say that nobody needs more FERC cases.
We love FERC cases. This doesn't scare us.
Can I ask you one practical question just on this auction rights issue, which is how practically does the payment work? So you sign an ISA, and then the bottom line figure says $10 million and change. And then is that owing at that point in time?
So what happens here with us, which might be the easiest way to understand it, is we have, right now we've paid the $10 million. That $10 million has been taken from PJM and paid to Marcus Hook. We've now paid it. They will now have options of going forward of getting auction revenue rights, which will in some way offset the payment we've made. Our last argument in the brief, if you reach it, and we don't think you need to get there because we think the first argument works, but is that Marcus Hook has already received auction revenue rights against the $10 million, and so we shouldn't have to pay Marcus Hook the $10 million. We should pay whatever that is. The problem is we don't know what it is. It might be that they've had a couple of million. We don't know. And the only people that know this is the commission. But if you look at the PJM, but if you look at the brief, the commission doesn't address this argument. They address the argument about us getting revenue rights in the future.
I don't see that I'm reading the commission's decision, not the brief. It looks like they're saying it's just not right then, for the very reason you told us a few minutes ago, which is up until the moment you sign, you can walk away. So why should they decide something before you can, because you might walk away?
So what we're talking about is once we sign the agreement, sort of everything collapses, and then going forward you get the revenue rights. What the debate is going forward, it's true, what they've said is it's not right because we're going to look at that as you proceed over time. But right now we're entitled to know whether we have to pay $10 million out of pocket and sign the agreement that says $10 million, or whether we pay $5 million out of pocket.
The ISA says the amount you have to pay to Marcus Hook.
That's part of the agreement. That's exactly, so that's the rate that is paid for the service of interconnection.
Your point is the offset means, in theory, you should change it from $10 million to $8 million or something like that. And so you need to know that when you sign on the dotted line.
Exactly, Ron. And it works very much into our earlier theory about what the filed rate is supposed to do, which is that when you sign, the tariff gives the terms, those terms supply
after
the terms.
After you sign, would you not be able to raise this issue?
Your Honor, we can raise the future, but I don't know how
Why can't you raise the past?
Because I don't understand what the mechanism would be for us to do that, in the sense that this is the time for us to challenge, as the commission has said, the terms of the interconnection agreement. If the interconnection agreement says you pay $10 million, once we sign and that is over, we can't re-challenge it anymore. I mean, we can argue questions about whether we're entitled to auction revenue rights, which are supposed to go out into the future. But the question of the cost allocation, that's like the rate. Here it is.
But isn't there some confusion? Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but it sounds to me when I read the agreement, it says if they, when you go up and ask them, hey, will you give us your auction rights, if they say no, you don't actually have to pay anything. You don't have to pay $10 million. You don't pay anything. Is that correct?
I don't think that's right. I'm not sure exactly what you're
saying. JA 767. In the event that a preceding customer chooses not to relinquish incremental auction rights, current customer shall have no cost responsibility.
Right. So that as I read that, that's the right of Marcus Hook to decide what it does.
But yeah, so in other words, if they decide that they want to keep those rights, you don't know anything. And one argument for not deciding this question until you sign is we don't know what Marcus Hook's going to be doing.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if that's the way that it works, but it's certainly not what the commission said. And I would go back to the briefs in this court, which is that we raised this point, and the commission doesn't answer by pointing to this or anything in their orders. They misunderstand the difference between future and current. And so at a minimum, I think the court would need to remand for the commission to explain whether it happens to read this the same way that you do.
Well, certainly would be a bit of pickle if you had to actually cut the check ISA,
and they already have the check. I mean, the money has already gone to them. So if they did that, you know, Pickle is absolutely right. But again, this is sort of why the file rate
doctrine. What triggered the money going to them?
Pardon, sorry?
What triggered the money going to them?
Well, when you sign when you submit the interconnection agreement unexecuted, right, you're preserving your right to dispute it, but a bunch of things come into play. So, for example, the West Deptford facility is already built and will be interconnecting, I believe it's in, don't hold me to this, but say in the next couple of weeks. So things don't stop just because there's a legal dispute. And so in order to keep moving forward with the need to get the facility interconnected, there are a number of milestones you have to do even under the interconnection
agreement. Are you saying that you wouldn't? You would just trash the facility if this were determined against you?
No, Your Honor. I mean, we would have the option of doing that, but there's no way we would do that, no.
And likewise, with respect to the notice about which tariff applies to you, is your position that you had to, I thought your argument was you have to know in advance which tariff is going to apply to decide whether you want to interconnect or not. But you're stuck interconnecting anyway.
Well, but Your Honor, I mean, the point is that you can't be put to just that choice. You have the right to look at the tariff that's on file. And when there's a negotiation that there was here that resulted in a new tariff that got rid of the unfair provisions and put new fair provisions, and we're entitled to say, just like everybody else, you can't discriminate against just us, we get the same rate as everybody else.
That's a different question than I thought the sort of policy question about, you know, leaving you in the lurch and not being fair to you about this. It seems to me you've gone forward knowing there's a risk. I mean, unless you've read our minds, you don't know what our answer is going to be here. So there's always been a risk.
Your Honor, all I would say is that when I refinanced my house on my mortgage, I mean, I got a bunch of cost studies, and given the situation where I was, I knew that I was going to go forward even if the estimates seemed to be too high. And when it came time for that I actually signed the mortgage, it turned out that the rate was lower than what they'd estimated me, and I took advantage of that.
But if the bank had filed in another proceeding in which your parent, as a parent might be the right thing in a mortgage. We're a party, and you knew there was a risk that not only that the estimate would be wrong, but they'd be applying a whole different rate structure.
With respect, Your Honor, if they had followed 205D, so if they had actually given to my parents a document that had been signed, and that document said, here's what you're agreeing to, but if they just provide notice in an offhand thing that isn't a schedule on file with the commission, then, you know, they could file the estimate to my parents and say, by the way, you're going to pay more than your son thinks he's going to get on his house, and, you know, knowing my parents, I'd be offended by that, but I also don't think it would be binding. And that's the point here, which is that there is a process under 205D that says if a utility PGM wants to change the rate, it can easily do that. It gives everyone 60 days notice. You can protest that. And it also gives them the opportunity to plainly state when it will be effective and what the change relates to.
Would you get money back from the from Marcus Hook or PJM, or what would happen?
Well, I think if the court was to send it back to the commission and say either that you have to make a new decision or you have to do this, what will happen is that there would be an order that would say there's been an overcharge here and you'd have to pay it back. But I don't know exactly how it would work. I just think that if the court goes ahead and rules us with us on the first issue, then the money does come back. We don't have to pay that. But thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Holly Kafer for the Commission. To back up just a little bit, I think it bears emphasis that West Deptford doesn't dispute that it did have actual notice here, and that's significant under this Court's precedent, in particular Consolidated Edison from 1992 and Public Utilities Commission of the State of California, those are both v. FERC, from 1993, which focuses on whether actual notice has occurred.
Have actual notice of what you did in the MISO cases and the other ones that they've cited, and the actual notice with Marcus Hook and all these other situations, you said that it's when you sign the interconnection service agreement. That's the tariff that governs. Do they have actual notice of those as well?
The Commission's precedent does not follow a straight path on this issue, as counsel has suggested.
And so they
yes,
have actual
in the
notice of a different answer. I mean, I don't know how actual notice works when the actual notice is contradictory.
The actual notice that I'm referring to is as to the effectiveness of the 2008 tariff going forward for the UTQ.
When you said straight path, did you mean that the Commission's precedent is all over the map, or do you mean it's not
no.
the path that your opposing counsel said?
It's not the path that opposing counsel said.
So what path
as the Commission
is, what
explained,
path is it?
The path is that the Commission takes a case-by-case approach to determining which tariff should apply to an interconnection agreement when that issue arises. In certain MISO cases, Midwest ISO cases, the Commission found that the tariff at the time of execution should apply. But in other cases, the Commission has emphasized that the importance, the significance of the queuing and
what
the
other cases
first come
apply the queue as the test for when the tariff covers.
In Marcus Hook, in fact, the Commission discussed at length and ultimately said that it's the tariff at the time the project, that is the generation project, is being considered that should apply.
Did you apply to Marcus Hook the tariff that governed when they got in the queue?
It's not clear to me because that argument wasn't made there. What was applied was the time at the time of execution. It was the tariff that was in place at the time of execution there. The Commission didn't refuse to apply a future tariff. That was the issue there because that would have been retroactive rate-making.
So I'm back to my original question. What case has the Commission applied the tariff in effect at the time someone got in the queue?
I don't think that I can cite to a specific case except to say there is a Midwest ISO case, 124 FERC 61 183 at paragraph 90, 2008, where the Commission did 124 FERC 61 183 at paragraph 90, 2008. The Commission accepted the Midwest ISO's proposal there to continue to apply the original tariff to already queued projects. And I believe
is that in the form of a new tariff?
It was in the tariff there.
So
that's the
difference. They don't object. They don't seem to have any dispute about if you put it into the filing.
Exactly. I mean, I read their reply brief actually to say it's true that the Commission has taken a case-by-case approach to when which
well,
tariff should apply.
What Judge Millett's asking is there, in all these case-by-cases, are there any cases where it's not actually in the tariff that it will apply at the time of the queue or something like that?
Much like counsel discussing the filed rate doctrine cases, I cannot really represent that there aren't any or that there may be one in the haystack somewhere, but I don't know of any.
You're not aware of any.
Right. But what I do have is commission precedent, including Marcus Hook 3, 118 FERC 61, 169, where the commission places emphasis on the interconnection queuing process and the first-come, first-served nature, and the fact that cost responsibility follows from queue positions.
That would make a lot of sense to me if you had a rule that said we're going to apply it to the queue. Those justifications would seem to apply across the board. I mean, there are articulable justifications for using the queue, and there are articulable ones for using when you sign the agreement.
And the commission is entitled to invoke a different rule based upon the particular facts and circumstances of the case.
That's the question I have for you. Really? They're entitled to pick and choose who gets which rule without any explanation as to why one gets one and one gets the other?
There is an explanation. First, under Section 205 of the Power Act, the utility is entitled to come to the commission with a proposal. So in the Midwest ISO cases, Midwest ISO, in most cases, proposed to apply new interconnection procedures effective immediately, including to those projects already in the queue. Here, PJM came in under Section 205 and proposed to apply it effective going forward from the U2 queue forward. Under Section 205, the Commission's authority is limited to determining whether that proposal is, in fact, just and reasonable. And in those cases, that's what the Commission did.
What about this language in 205D? Such notice shall be given by filing with the Commission and keeping open for public inspection new schedules stating plainly the change or changes and the time when the change or changes will go into effect. What about that language?
Here we get into whether the filed rate doctrine requires absolutely every particularity in that governs service.
Not every particularity, but here the statute expressly mentions the time. The time when the changes will go into effect.
Right, and so PJM's 2000.
What do you think it means by that?
I believe it means that the tariff should specify the effective date, and the 2008 tariff does specify an effective date, which PJM explained in its transmittal letter and again in its clarification pleading in 2008 meant 2008 forward because that's when the new queue starts, and never had any intention to apply that to existing queues.
I regard my one factual question about, because it was pretty explicit, actually, that they were going to apply it to the U2 queue, which closed on July 31st. So how can that be making it effective August 1st, if it's applying to people that were in the queue sometime prior to and ending on July 31st? J22, 23, 29, 555.
Right.
Here it keeps talking. So I was confused whether, in fact, the effective date is actually being adhered to.
I'm wondering if there might be an error in the year there, but perhaps counsel for PJM can clarify that factual question for you.
Okay, I'm just going to tell you, it's replete. I can give you a laundry list of record citations that all talk about July 31st, 2008 being the closing date for the U2 queue. And I thought everyone sort of agreed all around that the U2Q is the one that is supposed to apply to starting August 1st. So this seems to be just even more incoherence about when things start and stop in this scheme. And I confess
it could be, okay, so now I'm reading this. It could be that it is confusing. I apologize. Bear with me. It could be that... So the new queue starts on August 1st, 2008. PJM clarified it would apply to projects entering the queue starting July 31st, 2008.
And I don't want to...
Gosh, I'm not sure.
It'd be helpful, I suppose, if anyone can, maybe counsel for PJM can explain this.
I apologize for deferring the answer to that question yet again for you, but perhaps it helps to say that West Deptford hasn't raised any confusion as to that point, and the parties did agree, as the Commission noted, which tariff would apply depending upon the outcome of this case.
It's a question, though, of what it means for the tariff to apply and what it applies to. I think they certainly haven't conceded that. They're happy to have it apply August 1, 2008 because they didn't sign on the dotted line until after August 1, 2008.
In fact, they haven't signed on the dotted line at all yet, right?
Right, but I mean the relevant time for them
right.
is post-August 1, 2008.
Right. I'm still questioning whether there might be an error there. I'm just, I'd have to look into
it
further.
I'm talking about West Deptford. They're relevant. They say right. we don't dispute that y'all aren't affected. We put this whole thing that Judge Wood has aside. We don't dispute an August 1, 2008 effective date, but we get the benefit of that effective date because it's effective when you, it's effective to anybody who signs.
Right, and of course, they don't get the benefit of that date because PJM explained in its transmittal letter and again in the 2008 clarification that it was intended to apply August 1, 2008 going for the U2Q only.
Have you made the argument or are you relying on the rationale that those clarifications became part of the tariff?
The Commission approved those clarifications, or the transmittal letter and the later clarification, as part of its wholesale approval of what PJM proposed under Section 205 in the 2008 proceeding. So I guess you could say that in that sense, the interpretation of the effective date is part of the tariff.
It wasn't mentioned in the proceeding, was it? It wasn't mentioned in the approval.
In the order?
The Commission mentioned only a few items in that order approving, and that's because there were no protests or controversy. There was a request for clarification on the date. PJM answered that, and in the Commission's order, it noted one clarification of the effective date but not the other.
I mean,
we don't think that has controlling significance here.
You could have a rule under which subsequent clarifications become part of the tariff for purposes of the filed rate doctrine. And if that were the case, then there would be no issue because the stuff that comes along later in time actually becomes part of the tariff, and so it is part of the filed rate. But I take it you're saying that there is no such understanding.
I have not seen precedent along those lines.
And to be crystal clear, if I were someone who thought the statute meant what it said and that went to the schedules at the Commission, I wouldn't then see anything that would tell me about this August 1, 2008 date, or would I now be a schedule?
You would only see the reference to it being effective August 1, 2008. You would not see PJM's explanation of it. But under the filed rate doctrine and under this court's cases interpreting the filed rate doctrine, that doesn't matter. Two things here. First, the filed rate doctrine and the statute are, in fact, separate rules, let's put it that way. Yes, the filed rate doctrine derives from the statute. However, this court made it quite clear in the Columbia Gas case, which found that the Commission could not waive the filed rate doctrine, even though it could waive certain parts of the statute, that we are dealing with two separate things here. Second,
can't contradict the plain text of the statute, correct? The statute requires a plain statement of when a rate change is going to take effect. We can't create a judicial doctrine that says never mind.
But the tariff does state that, so I think that we're complying with the statute.
Well, it says
there.
August 1, 2008. It doesn't say August 1, 2008, but not you all because you were in the wrong line.
Which is why we get to this court's filed rate doctrine cases, which say what matters is notice. And, in fact, this court has looked outside the filed rate, the filed tariff itself, in order to determine whether notice was adequate. This happened in Transwestern Pipeline 1, v. FERC, 897 Fed 2nd, 570 at 577. It's cited in the Commission's brief at pages 3 and 17, where, among other things, they note that the cases on notice are not entirely clear. However, there the court looked to three Commission orders and to determine whether notice had been adequate. Now, in that case, it found that notice wasn't adequate. Likewise, it was not adequate for reasons specific to that case. Columbia Gas Transmission Corporation, 831 Fed 2nd, 1135 at 1141, the court again looked to whether a prior commission order was sufficient to put a party on notice and found that it wasn't because, and this is key, it was directed to the wrong set of customers. This was under the Gas Act. It was directed to first purchasers when the complaining customers were, in fact, downstream purchasers. Here, of course, we have notice directed to West Deptford in that it was a party to the 2008 proceeding and that it received direct notice throughout the interconnection process starting in 2006.
What could they have done?
In 2008, what could they have done? They were a party.
If the parent got this answer of PJM, what could they have done?
The parent did receive the answer, and it could have filed a protest to PJM's filing, objecting to it. It could have sought rehearing of the commission's letter order.
You're saying the parent could have done this?
The parent could have done
it. West Deptford have done it?
West Deptford was not a party. Certainly, they could have intervened. LS Power, a parent, had intervened in the 2008 proceeding, the Dominion settlement that led to these changes. In fact, Q90, West Deptford's project, is specifically addressed in that Dominion settlement. LS Power is a party to that settlement. Again, this is what gave rise to the PJM changes in 2008.
Which anybody who's going to be affected by anything that's said about a tariff has a legal obligation to jump into that commission proceeding and intervene in it and fight over what someone said in an answer or a brief?
Those are the facts here. LS Power had the opportunity as the parent of West Deptford.
I'm not asking what the facts are. I'm asking, do you really, as a policy matter, want to take the position that that puts you puts you on notice and such powerful notice that that's going to be your binding tariff terms unless you intervene in that in that commission proceeding and fight it out right then and there?
Yes, Your Honor, because the commission has always emphasized the significance of placement in and entrance into the interconnection queue. It's factual finding.
You never enforced it. You couldn't give me a single case where you've enforced that. That's the tariff that applies.
It hasn't had the opportunity, but that doesn't mean that it can't do so on the facts here, where, in fact, LS Power, as the parent, was a party to that prior proceeding, could have sought rehearing, could have sought judicial review.
Did you not have the opportunity to do it in the MISO cases? Could you have applied the Q tariff rather than the tariff in effect at the time they signed the agreement in that case?
So this is where we go back to the focus on the proposal under Section 205 of the Power Act. The commission could have done that, but it would have been a much harder case to make because that's not what was proposed to it. So it would have had to have found Midwest ISO's proposal in those cases to put the tariff in effect immediately. It would have had to have found that proposal unjust and unreasonable.
And
it had been offered no basis sufficient to do that. Just like here, it wasn't offered any basis in the 2008 proceeding for finding that PJM's proposal to place it in effect only for the U2Q forward was unjust and unreasonable. And LS Power, as the parent of West Deptford, intervening to protect its rights and its interests as a generation developer in PJM, had the opportunity to pursue those issues in that case, and it did not. And I think the commission would be quite comfortable with holding parties to the need to pursue issues in a case.
And isn't there a real problem? The statute, as well as the filed rate doctrine, care about notice, yes, but they also care about predictability and discrimination and picking and choosing which rate is going to apply to somebody. The whole reason that you have required filings and that be open and plain what their content is and when they apply is so that companies can't pick and choose who gets which rate. And in fact, Supreme Court of the Maitland case talked about the point of this being that there is one rate. And so what I want to ask your response to is how can that principle be consistent with a regime in which the commission one day says, you guys get this rate, and you guys get this rate.
With regard to market rules like these, interconnection, that are more or less constantly changing, there really isn't one rate. As counsel for West Deptford acknowledged, there are interconnection agreements that were executed under a 1996 or a 2000 version of the tariff that still adhere to that version of the tariff. Just the same way that here, the 2006 version of the tariff is the filed rate for West Deptford because that provides the necessary predictability to West Deptford and, I should add, to the dozens of other projects that were similarly situated with West Deptford that had the 2006 tariff applied to them.
So I just want to be clear then, because it seems to me for both parties, the issue is you have plain statutory language, but it doesn't say, is it what a filed rate? But it doesn't say when. You need that. What is the key point in time that you need that filed rate? And their position is it's when you're signing the either protesting or signing, when you're at the point of having the agreement and deciding whether to sign or not. And your position is that the statute and the filed rate doctrine cases actually allow a regime in which there is no rule about when we decide that filed rate has to be there. For one company, they could need it at one point in the process. In another company, it will be another point in the process. And as long as everyone has notice, that's okay.
This court has held that notice is, in fact, the central purpose of the filed rate doctrine. The whole purpose, the central purpose, words like that. And the commission is adhering to that precedent here.
But they don't have to have any filed rates at all. So, well, they should have done it, but they had notice. We told them what they were going to do.
There's no question that the facts of this case are not ideal. Certainly, they don't rise to the level of notice in, for instance, Natural Gas Clearinghouse that's discussed in the orders.
This is an expansion of the notice doctrine. This would be an expansion.
I don't think it's an expansion because if you look to the cases that I cited earlier, Transwestern 1, Western Resources, Columbia Gas from 1987, in those cases, perhaps the facts fell a bit short, but the court did establish some guideposts for, one, looking outside the filed rate to determine whether there is notice, looking outside the tariff that's on file itself. That bridge has already been crossed. The court has already done that.
But when can we look at it? Maybe if it would help if you could articulate to me, when is it that we get to say, never mind the rate that's on file, we're applying a different one because you had notice? Are there any limits, or is it just as long as there's notice?
I think that we can define the limits by the facts of this case where there was actual notice.
And so to be clear, then, your position is that the notice exception means that you have the filed rate or a different rate if you have actual notice.
Notice satisfies the filed rate. It's not really an exception to the filed rate, particularly as applied in these cases that I've referenced. So I don't think that the commission is straying from the statute at all when the statute is, I think as was evident by some discussion early on in opposing counsel's argument, not precisely clear as to whether to what extent the timing needs to be addressed in the tariff. The timing is addressed in the tariff. Here, what the commission does have the discretion to do is look at the facts to make factual findings as to adequate notice. And here it invoked its expertise as to the interconnection process to find that the time of entry into the queue is, in fact, the most significant. This is something that it's done since the beginning with PJM in particular. This is laid out nicely in the background to PJM's brief.
What's different for me is what's missing from the commission decision here is they say, hey, here's why we think we're going to use the queue for you. They don't explain why they're differently situated from all those other cases they have where the rate at the time of signing or at the time of the agreement is what governs. There's no explanation that I see from the commission as to why they're different. And those all that what they've done, all these other cases in the past, isn't going to apply today to West Deptford. And that's what I'm struggling with.
I understand, I think. At JA 32 and 33, the commission discusses the MISO cases and explains there that it focuses on, as it must under the statute, what Midwest ISO and here what PJM proposed in those cases. And so the statute essentially forces the commission to take a case-by-case approach.
Well, I just don't see that. I mean, the reading there, you say, yeah, we've done it differently, but that doesn't mean we're going to have a single coherent policy. We're going to do it case-by-case.
Right, which is also...
That's just declaring what you did. That's not justifying providing a decision as to why you're not going to do what you did before and why they're differently situated than the folks who are in MISO or all the other cases.
The commission has also, and this is in paragraph 42 from JA 33 to 34, it discusses Order 2003 and also the interconnection queuing practices order where the commission... explained that it does allow not only does Section 205 control what the commission can do in any given proceeding, but also that the commission has explicitly allowed regional transmission organizations, independent system operators like Midwest ISO and PJM to propose variations to accommodate their particular needs. This is not unusual.
We're going to make an exception this time, but I don't see why. What's different about WestJetFirst? Where does it say what's different? We have the power to do it, but what's different about WestJetFirst? Why are they getting a different answer other than PJM asked for it?
One, the fact that PJM asked for it is very significant under Section 205 as to the Commission's authority to change what a utility proposes.
How do you protect against the discrimination concerns if the only factor you're going to have is PJM asked for it?
There is no discrimination here because generators similarly situated to West Deptford were, in fact, treated the same way.
Under this exact same decision? Under this determination?
There were certainly generators that came before West Deptford that came before the U2Q.
But under the same PJM, I mean...
You're just saying that the baseline... I think you're talking about a different baseline because I think Judge Millett's question is, if the baseline is not just the PJM, but if you look at all the FERC determinations across time, West Deptford is being treated differently because the rate that's being applied here is as long as you're in the queue, you're in. It's not pegged to the time that you sign the ISA. And I think what you're saying is, well, they're similarly situated to the other people who are in the queue, and that's definitely true. I think. The question is, what's the relevant baseline? Is it as long as there's no discrimination as between everybody who's subject to this particular order, or is the relevant baseline across time? We're talking about different orders too. And as to seem to be that this is unique.
PJM is allowed to be unique from the Midwest ISO under the Commission's precedent, in particular here, Order 2003, interconnection queuing processes. I can also point the court to Order Number 2000, which established established regional transmission organizations and emphasized there that there can be regional variation.
One way to ask the question maybe is why was there the rule, the other approach, that was pegged to the time of the ISA in the other cases? Because what was the value judgment that underlay that choice?
My familiarity with the Midwest ISO cases is that the interconnection queue was so dysfunctional in those cases that there was a need to apply the new procedures immediately. And let's keep in mind, the Commission does not have a single policy on when...
In all the MISO cases, were they in the tariff, the issue of when the new tariff would apply?
To my understanding, yes, and okay. That is
so
the distinction.
That seems like a different issue. So I don't understand, and I will certainly ask, opposing counsel to be arguing that you can't treat PJM different than MISO or any of the other ISOs. In this way, that it was unreasonable to pick the queue as the time. As I understand their argument, it's not in the tariff. And if you wanted to do that, you had to put it in the tariff, and then they might challenge reasonability. But I don't understand the reasonability to be the issue here. The issue here is not, is being in the tariff. Is that right?
That's my understanding as well.
So
I think
answering that,
that
PJM can be treated differently than MISO or CAISO or anybody else isn't really an answer. Yes, maybe they can be treated differently. The question is whether the difference in treatment has to be reflected in the tariff or not.
I think that is the question before this court. I was trying to answer the questions from the panel in terms of talking about regional variation. But I do think that by the time we get to the reply brief here, the issue is whether the interpretation of the filed of the effective date needs to be in the actual tariff. And we assert that under the cases I've mentioned regarding reasonable notice under the filed rate doctrine, that's not the path that this court has followed.
So we're way over time. Let me just ask quickly, what is the answer to the question raised by opposing counsel about the past money that Marcus Hook has already got?
The commission didn't reach that issue. We're talking about auction revenue rights, and the commission did not reach that issue
they're not talking about the rights anymore. They're talking about payments.
Offset.
Right. So that's what happens is Marcus Hook has received.
I understand what happens.
Okay.
The question is,
what can they do?
In your view, is the commission has decided both questions, past payments and future payments, are both not ripe yet?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And what is the reason for why it's not right to decide the past payments issue yet?
Because the determination of the amount of ARRs that auction revenue rights that Marcus Hook might give up, if they give it up at all, has not been made because that section of the tariff, 231.4, has not been triggered and will not be triggered unless and until West Deptford signs the interconnection agreement. There is no reason why upon signing, if West Deptford is unhappy with the result under 231.4, it can't bring that challenge to the commission at that time.
But can it get out of the deal altogether?
I'm not certain about that. I suppose a contract is a contract and maybe.
So they're being required to sign a contract where they don't know the amount of money at issue.
The tariff seems to control there. And the tariff, and they haven't actually challenged the reasonableness of the tariff in this
case.
They
say 231.4 doesn't apply to the offsets. It only applies to the future incremental auction and revenue rights. Is that wrong?
The commission didn't address that issue here, so I can't really answer that. That's for a future case at such time as West Deptford executes the interconnection agreement. And there, you know, to the extent the commission finds that a different allocation of auction revenue rights or money is appropriate, the commission can affect that refund if necessary.
Am I reading it right when J-767, the determining the market for community rights, you wouldn't have to pay anything for the entire facility?
Again, I have to say that the commission didn't address that issue, but my understanding is that here Marcus Hook controls whether or not it wants to receive reimbursement by relinquishing its ARRs. So I think you may be correct, but I'm just speaking on behalf of myself and not the commission there, since the commission didn't address this in the orders. These provisions are simply not triggered until the agreement is signed. Again, the commission didn't address that, so I'm not entirely clear on the process there. Perhaps PJM's counsel can fill in the blanks a bit there.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. I don't think we save any time for PJM's counsel, so I'll leave it up to the panel whether they want to hear. Okay, the answer is yes. And I think it would be best if judges who want to ask questions just direct them to you directly rather than you're making a presentation to begin with. So
that's fine.
You want to start with the internet first question about 767?
Well, I think all I would simply say with you, by the way, Paul Flynn from PJM Interconnection. I think all I would simply say is that nothing's been foreclosed on that. As Mr. Parrish said, they've already paid the $10 million. That's been transferred.
What the language means. Does it mean that if Marcus Hook doesn't give up his ARRs, they don't have to pay anything to the facility?
It is a requirement, yes, it is a requirement that Marcus Hook has to give a third letter in order to receive, I guess the reimbursement would have to be rescinded if they refuse to give up the AROs. And I don't think there's any question that they would not give up the AROs.
Can you also ask my question about the U2Q?
I apologize, Judge Millett. I don't have a specific answer for that. My sense is that the applicability to the U2Q was something that was proposed in the stakeholder process that led to this 2008 change. There were a couple of allocation changes going on there, and the stakeholders, those folks involved with it, said, these are all good changes, but for folks that are already in the queue, we don't want to change the rule on them. So let's change the rule going forward. And they selected the U2Q. And what I would say is the U2Q was the queue that was open while this 2008 change was pending in FERC, and applying it as of just after the date it closed, make sure you capture everybody in that queue. But in any event, PJM was clear in the filing.
So it was applying to people who were in the queue before August 1st, 2008.
I'm sorry?
It was applying to people who were in the queue before August 1st, 2008.
That one queue group that was...
It's just a yes or no question. It applied to people before August 1st, 2008.
Yes. And so just to respond to one of the points that...
I'm going to leave it up to the judges to ask you questions.
So, did you have one?
No.
Why didn't you have a grandfathering provision in this tariff?
Was going to be the same question I was going to ask.
Okay, which is an excellent question. Obviously, it would have been better if we had, because then we all wouldn't have been here. But it is certainly customary that when you file one of these tariff changes, and we're filing them all the time, that you address effectiveness in the transmittal letter. That's very customary. And in this case, the lawyers putting it together obviously saw effectiveness in terms of queues, because this is the interconnection process and you're always thinking in terms of a queue. You're juggling these different periods of time. Here's a group here, and then there's a successive group, and then there's a successive group. And so they think of that effectiveness in terms of the queue, and so they simply addressed it in the transmittal letter, because it's simply customary to address effectiveness in a transmittal letter. And that's what they did.
The transmittal letter said exactly what?
It said that it would be effective on August 1st, 2008, for the next open queue.
It said because the next open queue is that date.
Yes. And so, again, the concept was...
It ended up not being that queue. It ended up being applied to a different queue.
Understood. Again, the concept was to preserve the expectations of the folks that were already in the queue. That's
so what would happen now if we were to agree with West Deptford? What other expectations are upset by that?
Well, there were two that's worth talking about, because there were two allocation rules that were proposed in that filing that had this similar sort of treatment. There was this rule of changing the specifics of that five-year look back where someone could be responsible for a previously completed project, which is the source of the $10 million issue. There was also a question of within one queue group, which is a multi-month group where we'll put them all together, how will we allocate facilities that cost less than $5 million? The rule before had been within that queue group, if you're number one or you're number two or you're number three, we could allocate it based on the priority within the group. We changed that so that it would be pro rata based on the contribution of each party within that group, sort of pro rata percentage contribution. And we told FERC, and we only want, as we did with this one, we only want that rule to be effective beginning with the Q2 and later Qs, the U2 and later Qs. And that's exactly what we did. That's exactly how we applied it.
That's also not reflected in the tariff itself.
It was in the proposal, but not in the tariff section itself. No, it's
all
not in the tariff.
All of that would be up for grabs if we decided.
Unfortunately, yes. Unless there's some time bar to it, I can't vouch for that.
Is there anybody else in West Deptford's position also in that queue who this would make a difference to?
On the specific issue of the five-year look back, I think it only affects essentially whether West Deptford or Marcus Hook has to bear the $10 million. But the implication of that, of a ruling you're discussing, could well affect these other
key projects. So it will affect, if we go this way for West Deptford, then Marcus Hook is, as they say, on the hook. Is that correct?
Yes.
Or is PJM on the hook?
No, it would be Marcus Hook.
But do the auction rights not in the end equal out the amount that they have to pay?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Do the auction rights that, that they've gotten, do those not in the end equal the amount? This was $10 million, I take it.
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. It's not going to be 100% recruitment.
So a decision for West Deptford would mean a decision against Marcus Hook?
That's correct.
Are they a party in this case?
They are. They joined us on the brief. And again, so from our perspective, we had to apply the tariff in this fashion because we told FERC this is how we wanted to apply it, and in their order, they accepted our proposal. We didn't, to answer your question about clarification given by the tariff, we didn't see that we had any alternative but to apply it exactly as we told FERC we would apply it. And that's exactly what we did.
And is that's in the docket number that's reflected on JA-552? Is that right? Where you made the answer and clarified.
Yes.
That's the docket
yes,
which this was.
In that clarification, we walked through how this would apply, how each of the rule changes that was in that docket, how they would be applied. For most of the cases, we said, look, the practical effect is there would be no difference for the earlier queues and for the later queues. For these, there would be a difference, and as a result of the stakeholder process, and this is what they wanted, we said, so this will apply, these two rules will only apply to folks in the U2 queue and later, and that's exactly how we applied it, again, to uphold the expectations of those folks who are in the queue, because cost allocation, regardless of whether the tariff applies, all the terms of the tariff apply, the queue position is critically important for ultimately what cost you're going to bear.
At the time in which this was being decided, West Deptford was in the queue, is that right?
Absolutely, yes.
So is it correct that the only way they could have found out about this clarification is by sending some paralegals to constantly read FERC's files, or are people in the queue on notice that they can be affected by this kind of proceeding?
Well, West Deptford is probably not the perfect example to use in this case. Because in West Deptford's case, there was just so much notice, and their parent was involved in the case, so I think there's no question but that they knew what was going on. I think your question probably relates to the more hypothetical question of how can someone else know? And I would simply tell you that as a FERC practitioner, if I'm relying on a tariff provision for whether or not my client has to pay $10 million or not, I would certainly take a look at the order where FERC changed that tariff provision, and if the order says, oh, wait a minute, PJM filed a clarification, there's some issue as to when this would apply, I would look at that also.
But then you wouldn't object, you wouldn't be in a position to object to it until you're at the position they were here, ready to sign the interconnection service agreement, and that's when how you serve the issue up to FERC.
Well, again.
You don't say they did anything procedurally improperly by challenging at the time.
Their options always were to drop out of the queue and become a later queued project. They always had that option, as he said, but there would be consequences to that. They would be jumping out of the possible $10 million cost if they stay in that queue versus an uncertain level of cost if they jump to another queue, but they had that option. So that's part of the evaluation that they would have to make. As you said, it's a certain extent of having your cake and eating it too.
And there's one other company that's affected here, I think. Is Liberty not affected?
They were on the hook for 10%, so mm-hmm. they would get the same treatment. I'm not sure why they didn't continue to pursue it.
Other questions? Okay, I'm sure we're out of time.
Thank you.
I think if we can again restrict you to answering our questions, I think that will be a lot better given how much time has passed here. So my question about this is, and in a way it relates to the policy question that you asked or the practicality question you asked.
Yes.
They have a proceeding in which PJM's tariff is at issue. There are a lot of players in that proceeding, all of whom could be affected in a lot of different ways. Doesn't the FERC have an interest in resolving those disputes during that proceeding rather than resolving that proceeding and then waiting until somebody interconnects later and throwing the entire proceeding off? That is, the other parties who have relied on the results of that proceeding.
So, Your Honor, two answers to that. One is that if they have an interest, there's a way that they could set it up that might be consistent with the statute, but they haven't done that here. In fact, in all their orders, they say the opposite. I think you're also referring to is maybe what you asked opposing counsel about whether we could have protested the answer.
Yeah.
And her answer to that is wrong, and it's wrong for two reasons. First, you cannot protest answers. What you do is you protest final orders by the commission.
Well, you could also have filed, not you, but your parent could have filed a request for clarification or they could have appealed at that point the result of the order approving. Right?
So let me make the point about the order. We couldn't have done that because the order approving only said that it applied to $5 million or less. It didn't say anything about the $10 million or more. So the letter order didn't address it. And that's why the letter order, even though it's raised in the commission's brief but not below, doesn't count. The other point.
So we don't know whether FERC approved this or not.
FERC did not approve it. No, there's no.
What if FERC had approved it?
Well, Your Honor, I think this may be the answer that could be a difference between the $5 million or less and the $10 million or more. If the commission in a letter order had said, we're accepting the tariff on these terms, what it would have done is it would have said, you need to clarify the tariff, but the argument would have been much greater for someone to say, look, there's a letter order that approves the tariff, and that will count as part of the tariff. Your Honor, that was sort of your question as to what is in the tariff, because you might have an argument that is part of a schedule. We don't have that here. And even still, what the commission typically does then is it says amend your tariff to clarify this point. And if I may, Your Honor, if it helps, you'd asked a question about Marcus Hook. And I would just note that Marcus Hook has been here before. Marcus Hook litigated for 8 years the question of whether they would be responsible for these upgrades. And the commission said, you will because you signed the agreement. And on remand from this court, there was a question as to whether it could take advantage of the new tariff. And the commission said, no, because you have to look at where the tariff was signed. The only thing I'd say, and then unless you have questions, is that if I could just urge upon the court, the notice exception cannot be actual notice, because if it is actual notice, then the statute doesn't exist anymore and the filed rate doctrine doesn't exist.
There are other questions from the panel? All right.
Thank you very much.